The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Graham Norton, good morning.
And to you.
Congratulations, first of all. What about the best kept secret in West Cork?
Well, actually, it wasn't very well kept in West Cork, but they kept it in West Cork. They were very good at not letting it spread. No, we had a big wedding party this summer, and like even the guests didn't know. Well, yeah. They don't have to be stupid if they didn't know. But some of them claimed not to know. But we certainly didn't tell them. And so they all rocked up. And
why did you decide to tie the knot at this point in your life? I mean, you could have carried on.
I could.
And you do carry on.
Yes. It seemed, I don't know, it sounds odd. When I say that I'm married and I use the phrase my husband, like, I mean, I do have a husband, but it does sound like I'm making it up. I haven't quite, you know, got there yet. But I always think, you know, to get married later in life, it seems easier to me. You know, till death do us part at my age seems more achievable. Yeah. Whereas at 20, that's a big ask.
Okay, so you give yourself a few decades. You can manage that, you think, until death knocks on the door.
Fingers crossed. And
the reason I ask this is because in your new book, Forever Home, there is a married gay couple.
Yes.
And this book had to be written a long time before your actual marriage. And I'm wondering, was their harmony stroke disharmony sort of getting you thinking about tying the knot? Or was the seed sown a lot earlier than that?
I really hope that relationship played no part in me getting married. I mean, I think there are things that certainly I hear friends talk about, that gay couple talk about. You know, the pressure to get married. Because once the referendum happened, it was like a shotgun wedding for every gay couple.
Why do you not want to marry
them? Yeah. And also, all that thing, all the friends going, we voted for it. Why aren't you doing it? You told me you wanted to do this. So I feel like there was a kind of pressure. But I must say, I didn't feel that pressure.
Okay. Now, and it obviously went very well to the point that you feel you can absent yourself for long periods of time plugging your book.
Yes. Well, no, he's very busy too. So that's all good.
Now, the book itself, one of the characters in the book is, in fact, a house. In fact, one of the principal characters in the book is a house. Does that house exist? I mean, have you got a template for that in your head?
It's a couple of places. There's a little terrace in Bantry, kind of tucked away, that I sort of saw in my mind's eye. There's little bits of my house in London in it. Because that idea, I like that idea of being in old houses. You know, my house in London is 1811. And that thing that Carol does of, you know, reading a book and wondering, has someone read that book in this house before? I love that idea, that the house has outseen everybody.
Now, the best way to approach this book, because there are lots of twists in it, so therefore spoilers must be avoided at all costs. So I thought the best way to talk about the book was through the dramatis personae.
Okay.
So Carol is your principal protagonist in this. She is living with, but not married to, Declan, who was married before to Joan, who's missing, and Declan has children, Sally and Killian. Killian's the one who's got married to his gay partner. Sally is in the wilderness.
You could pass an exam. I'm very impressed.
So, no, it's a great cast of Irish characters.
Yeah, I mean, you get a germ of an idea and that sticks and you're plugging away at that. And how could that open up into a novel? And it was how to make the world big enough. Because really, what started it was just that relationship between Carol and Declan. Because I think you always imagine that people in later life, older couples, they're very stable. You imagine they've been together for 30 years, 40 years. But of course, that's not the world we live in. Lots of people finding love for the second time or the third time. You know, there are people in their 70s who have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And if you're in that situation, you don't have that stability. And hence, if something happens to one of you, what happens? And that was where the whole thing started. And then it opened out into these other characters. And then there's this kind of mystery.
The mystery.
There's a mystery in the house. Because I love a plot. I like to know why I'm reading a book. I like to know why I'm turning these pages.
At the beginning, I'm wondering whether this is going to be kind of a sad book, maybe a bit about Alzheimer's and dementia and all of that. And I didn't see the mystery coming. And then metaphorically and literally, my nose twitched.
yes, that does happen. For me, it was deciding where to put that central mystery. And I was sort of surprised that it happened, because I imagined it would happen earlier.
It didn't happen earlier. And that was the point. I'm saying, what is Graham doing in this one? Because it's described as something of a mystery. And then, lo and behold, the mystery unfolds.
It does. And also, the thing that surprised me about this book was, because you're right, it starts off and it's in a very dark place. But some of the characters are just funny. I mean, Carol's mother, Moira, is a funny character. She makes me laugh.
She's quite intrepid in her own domineering way.
Yes. But, and she's very good at what, you know, she knows what she's doing and she's good at it. But
her father, by the way, who was probably the original grotty crotty, was he not?
Yes.
Because he is someone who's built himself a house that he probably doesn't really like.
No, and you know that house.
Yeah.
And we know the people who live in them. Those kind
who
of,
insist on bringing the old sofa from the last place, and it doesn't
exactly
fit.
So sort of Malibu glass and chrome thing. Yeah. And they've got a pine dresser propped against a wall.
No, it's a fabulous book, and it unfolds, and it's very satisfactory, shall I say.
Thank you. It's denouement.
I like an ending. But we can't dwell on that because we'll give too much away. In the meantime, Holding's been on the telly.
Yeah.
Now, did you have hand actor part in its adaptation? And if not, why not? And what did you think of it?
Well, they asked me, and I just thought, I'd spent my time with those characters. And I think also adapting something, that's a skill. It's a job. Yeah. And it's a skill I don't have. So I was very happy to say, knock yourselves out, see what happens. So I really enjoyed the process because no responsibility at all. And I got to see, you know, because obviously they'd open, that's a very small book. My book is a very small book, a very closed little world. And they had to open it up to make it a television show and have subplots and other things going on. So that I found really interesting. It was really interesting to see the casting, how they saw the characters compared to how I'd seen the characters. In the end, they're actors, so they're all better looking than real people.
Paulie McGlynn will be delighted to get that compliment from you.
The beautiful Brenda Fricker.
The idea, though, and I read somewhere you said this, that the characters may change in the adaptation, but the principal character, Wes Cork, remains the same.
And can I just say, hats off to the production company and Dominic Treadwell, Collins. He is a house in Skibbereen. His family's from there. And he really moved heaven and earth to film it in West Cork. Because, of course, it's much more expensive. You know, if you film it outside Dublin somewhere, you know, a British audience will have no idea that that's not West Cork. And it will cost a fraction. Whereas West Cork, you've got to bring everything in. But I'm so glad he went the extra mile because West Cork really is the star of it.
Now, when your books come out or when Holding is shown on TV, like, it's a small place. I don't care how many expats and blow-ins live there. And they're all wondering, is that Maisie down the road or is that Sean? Oh, yeah.
Well, Dominic was asking me about this and I was going, no, a lot of the places are based on things, but none of the characters are real. And then when he was
any
doing,
resemblance to persons living or dead.
So in the book, there are these three sisters, the Ross sisters, and they live in this little town called Dunneen. And Dunneen is kind of loosely based on Durris. So on a recce, you know, they're going to see the locations, they go to Durris. And he called me up afterwards. He said, you do know there's a pub owned by three sisters called the Ross sisters. I didn't. And they must be fuming that I've stolen their lives. But I genuinely didn't know they existed.
And then your verdict on Holding on TV, what did you think overall?
I really enjoyed it. And I thought what they did very well was kind of that kind of brave storytelling. Like that Brenda Fricker monologue isn't the sort of thing you see on telly.
Yeah.
I think directors and writers are kind of too nervous to do things like that. They would normally have told that in a flashback. In fact, in the book, I told it as a flashback. Yeah. But it was great to give it to Brenda as this real tour de force, look at me, how good I am moment.
You weren't on set, I presume, or were you? For
I went, well, this is bad. Look, it was COVID and you had to have PCR tests. And I'm in West Cork, it's quite hard to get one. So I only went once, but I did enjoy it.
No, the reason I wanted to find out if Brenda Fricker really rode that mobility cycle. That was the question.
She was on it. I've seen the rushes. She was on it. Other people were on it too. Would we call them a stunt person?
A stunt double for Brenda.
A stunt double for Dub. Quite an easy day's work for the stunt double. But yes, she was there in the shell suit.
Now, the writing obviously is something you enjoy profoundly. How different is it from the day job? Because the day job, TV is, you know, it's hard to make. And other people, you know, if one person gets it wrong, the designer, the props guy, the sound guy, any of the cameras, the director, the vision mixer,
yeah,
you know,
it's a lot.
There's a lot going on.
But even in radio, there are more people, you know, that before you do your show, presumably you have a meeting or someone's giving you briefing notes and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's collaborative. And so if I wrote all the time, I think that would drive me crazy. But as an alternative to the rest of my life, I love it. The kind of the solitude of it and that I can say, okay, I did this. If you don't like it, if you do like it, I did it. I tried my best and there it is. Whereas, as you say, on television, I can kind of go, oh, sorry about that show, but I mean, I don't know what they were thinking with the lighting, or, you know, they forgot to turn all the microphones on. It's not my fault. Whereas this is my fault. This is entirely my fault. And I quite like that.
Now, in television terms, how long has the talk show been going?
Various
iterations.
But basically, I started doing So Graham Norton on Channel 4 in 1998. So 25, 24 years, something like that. So it's a long old time.
And does the end beckon at all? Or will you, you know, they always say that the public fire you, you know.
Exactly. Or because I'm at the BBC, you know, it could just be a new head of television who just goes, you know what? We're going to do something else. We're going to mix it up and da da da. I'm going to make my mark on television and get rid of that tired old show. And you have to just, you know, take it on the chin because I have had a bigger slice of the pie than I deserve. You know, presenters who started in 1998 with me, they're not on telly. The very few of them, anyway. So I am very lucky. The other really lucky thing is I still enjoy it. I still really get a kick out of it. We just started a new season, and to get back into the studio with that full audience and the sofa back, it was exciting. And you don't expect to be...
I mean, the COVID experience was diminished. There's no question about it, no matter how hard people tried. Deficits in your lineups. I mean, who did you try to get desperately and never got? Now, don't say Vladimir Putin. He doesn't speak good enough English.
You can zoom in. I feel like the only person who hasn't talked to President Zelensky. Have you?
Not yet. But
Barbara Streisand. She had a Zoom call with him the other night. Who have we tried? I mean, we've never had Brad Pitt on. I'm pretty confident in saying we've never had Julia Roberts on. I don't think we've had her on. The Young Royals, I'd like to have the Young Royals on because I think it'd be quite interesting to see them in that context and to see what they're like with an audience and what an audience made of them.
Yeah, I mean, it probably would be highly controlled if it were to happen.
And also, it's all highly controlled. You don't need the Young Royals for that. Most of these people have publicists and managers, and there is a line you need to walk. And the trick is to make it look like everyone's relaxed and having fun, rather than don't mention the husband, don't mention the terrible film, don't mention the whatever we've been talking about.
I mean, that's the difference. I labored on the Late Late Show for 10 years, and it was always light and shade. I mean, some nights there would be tragedy, other nights there might be a Jimmy Carr rocking up and making everyone laugh hilariously. But you're unremittingly up.
Yes, it's just funny. Even in the first show, we had Eric Idle telling a really dramatic story about getting a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. But he by sheer fluke, got it so early, they were able to catch it, you know, because that doesn't happen. And so that would be a dramatic human interest story, but on our show, it was sort of an anecdote. he just told it as a funny thing that happened to him. I think if ours was the only chat show, that would be a weakness. But I think there are other places you can go to tell a story in a different way, or interview someone.
You're not going to be Misery Boots.
Not going to be Misery Boots, and I'm not going to interrogate people, or, you know, I'm just, that's not what the show's for. And I know that might frustrate people, but I think an audience wouldn't like it. And also, you can't sort of, you know, have a big truth bomb in the middle of the show, because then you're stuck on a sofa with these people. You've got to keep going.
Anyone ever burst into tears because of a question or a memory or a...
John Voight told an anecdote so moving, he made himself cry, and we cut it out.
You cut it out. Now, Eurovision.
Oh, yes.
You know, the story's breaking. Graham's not going to do the commentary anymore. Is that because Graham might be presenting the show?
No. I think what I said, because I think the story is breaking that I'm not going to host. And I didn't say that either. What I said was, I don't know what's happening. All I know is I'm nervous of giving up the commentary, because you know what it's like? Someone else will do it, and then they'll be better than me. And then I've stupidly lost my favourite gig. So I want to... If I can do both, that'd be great. But my priority would be doing the commentating, because I really enjoy doing that.
All right. Finally, we should return to your literary work.
Oh, yes.
Something else on the stocks after Forever Home?
Yeah, I will. I give myself a year to write these books. So I start in April and finish in April. So I'll start another one next April, and hopefully I'll be back here in 2 years.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll both still be around and talk about that one.
Yeah. Now, the last question, really, you say a book like Forever Home is your own work. Do you actually trample the grapes to make your wine?
No, but I drink this. I do drink it. So if that's the work that's involved, I'll do it. But yeah, I don't.
Graham Norton, what a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Oh, thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.